of thinking of the past. He had been wallowing in it for a year. He was ready to move forward. That was what taking this job, moving to this town, had been about. Ethan was settling in. At least he wasn't scowling all the time. And their relationship was still wobbly, but Jack wasn't sure how much of that was teen angst and how much was the lingering effects of his mother's absence. Jack didn't look forward to the conversation he needed to have with Ethan about his marriage, especially now that he hoped it would be followed by another conversation about a certain bookstore owner. But Jack was getting way ahead of himself. First, he needed to figure out what to say to Ellie and find a time to say it. He took the city hall stairs, two at a time. Susan looked up when he entered.
"Hey, Chief."
"Susan."
"Where's the coffee from?"
The cup in his hand was plain brown, 80% post-recycle, about as nondescript as you could get.
"Let me guess, you don't recognize the cup. It isn't from the Chevron, Dairy Queen, diner, or one of ours."
"Yeah."
"It's from the book bank."
"Did Ellie tell you about tonight?"
"Tonight?"
"Her business launch. She probably figured I had already mentioned it to you. She asked me to last week and I forgot. Oh, what with your,
She waved her hand at her head. "It's a party?"
"Yes, 7 o'clock, at her store, a reception. Ethan's invited, too. My kids will be there. Give you a chance to meet more people. You should come."
She buzzed Jack through the door. Jack took the invitation as a good sign. He would talk to Ellie tonight, then.
"I think we will."
Miner was sitting in his office at one of the two desks, looking through files. Jack took the chair in the vacant one.
"Morning."
"Morning, Chief."
He closed the file and put it in his desk drawer.
"What's that?"
Just some paperwork I'm behind on."
Jack sipped his coffee and looked from the drawer to Miner. He doubted it.
"You still don't think the Dodsworths dumped a body in their woods 50 years ago?
"No."
"Okay, then.
How far would you drive to dump a body?"
The officer's lips fluttered.
500 miles?
"Before interstates?"
Miner shrugged.
"I'd want to get it as far away from my home as possible. Transporting a body out of state would make it a federal crime, which means we could pass it off to the feds," he said.
Miner was one of the most taciturn people Jack had ever met. But with that suggestion, he was downright ebullient.
"Why would we want to do that? We aren't ever going to be able to establish where the woman died 50 years ago anyway, just where she's buried."
Miner's face fell. He leaned back in his chair and sighed, resigned.
"This is Texas," he said. "You can drive 500 miles without leaving the state. Easy."
Jack stared at the map of Texas on the wall.
"Using 500 miles, staying in Texas," Jack mused, "would mean they drove from south of Houston or west of Dallas, Austin, San Antonio. If you're west of those cities, just drive into the desert. You could dump a body out near Big Bend and it would never be found.
If you were coming from Houston, why come north 500 miles? Go south 500 miles and dump the body in Mexico,"
Miner said.
"Hell, there are so many bodies in their desert that one more would hardly be cause for investigation.
There's also the ocean. Go far enough out and it would never be found. If you were coming from the east, Louisiana, Mississippi, or north from Arkansas and Tennessee, why stop here? Keep going to the desert or ocean, unless you knew the area." "Which brings us back to a local," Jack said.
They stared at the map for a while in silence. Jack drank his latte and let his mind wander. It was a damn good latte.
"Problem is, Chief, there aren't any local missing persons reports from the 60s.
Jack nodded.
"That is a problem. I suppose, to be thorough, we should expand the missing persons reports from Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Mississippi."
He tapped a pencil on the desk.
"Occam's razor."
"What?" Miner asked.
"When you have two competing theories, the simplest solution is usually the correct one."
Miner remained silent.
"Especially when you consider the fact the land has been out of use for 50 years, and Elizabeth Dodsworth specifically kept it fallow."
Miner leaned forward and picked up a blue Bic pen. He held it upright, flipped it over, ran his fingers down to the bottom, and repeated the action.
Chief, I've been wondering.
What?
Well, is there really much point in investigating this? A 50-year-old murder with no identification, no evidence, and no leads? If it was the Dodsworths, the old man is dead and Elizabeth is senile. All finding out would do is sully their name. Gotta think how it would affect Barbara, too.
I've thought of that. But aren't you curious, just a little?
Not particularly.
Plus, we've got the Ramos case. I'll take care of the Ramos case. You're in charge of this one.
I'd rather pull a month of night shifts.
I'm sure Starling would be thrilled, but no. Talked to Sheriff Newberry this morning. She's pulling missing persons files for you. Have to go through them in Yorkville, though.
I think it's a waste of time.
Jack watched Miner play with the pen and let the silence linger.
Is there a reason you don't want to pursue this case?
Miner let the pen drop.
It ain't that. What if it turns out to be linked to the Dodsworths? The town won't take kindly to you coming in here and opening old wounds.
Miner finally looked up and said with a sly grin,
They run you out of town. They'll put me in charge.
Jack laughed.
I appreciate your concern, but we're going to pursue this case no matter where it takes us. Do you understand?
Miner nodded.
Yes, sir.
Good. Now, let's talk about the Ramos case.
All right.
Jack smiled at the way Miner was able to draw out two syllables for so long. He drummed his fingers on the desk.
Got the partial crime scene report when I went to Yorkville. Rosa wasn't the shooter.
Pretty much what we thought.
Gun was last sold to Justin Dixon.
Well, he buys guns and sells them privately. That's what Ann said. Don't see him having a motive to kill them.
We'll see.
So, who would want to kill two hard-working Mexicans that seem to get along with everyone?
Miner asked.
Obviously, they didn't get along with everyone.
Well, how do you go from being well-liked to someone wanting to put a bullet in your head?
Without there being at least some small indication something was going on.
Jack finished his coffee, tossed the cup into the trash can by the door.
Have you heard anything from the feds about Diego?
The feds?
Yeah, didn't you run Diego through the DEA?
No. Did you want me to?
Jack stared at the ground. Hadn't he asked Miner to run Diego?
In this very office?
Jack shook his head to clear it.
It wasn't coming back. I thought I did. I probably hallucinated it. I've been having some crazy dreams the past few nights.
The phone beeped. Susan's voice sounded through the intercom.
Chief? Juanita down at county called. Files are ready for Miner.
Thanks, Susan.
Jack stood.
Well, that was fast. Must mean there aren't many files. Good news, huh?
Yeah, great. Where are you off to?
Back out to the Ramos's trailer. See if we missed anything.
All right.
First, though, I think it's about time I met Buck Pollard.
4. Jack got lost 3 times on the way to Buck Pollard's house. Miner's directions were awful, the directions of a man who knew which way to turn on every road in the county by sight, but couldn't remember the road numbers. Weird for a man Jack suspected of having a perfect memory. Pollard's house was so remote, so deep in the piney woods, Jack's phone wouldn't work, making his maps app pointless. Of course, his car didn't have GPS. When Jack turned around for the 3rd time, he let the idea lingering in the back of his mind come forward. Miner purposely tried to get him lost. He drove back to the main highway, pulled over, and called Violet, the dispatcher, on the radio for better directions. With a chuckle, Violet recited the same directions Miner had given him, this time with road numbers, before telling him that Hugh Barnes left a message. He had some preliminary information about the skeleton. Jack called Hugh back immediately and apologized for being out of pocket.
Why people choose to live in the middle of nowhere, I don't know, Jack complained. Says the man who just moved to a small town. But I live inside the city limits. There's a big difference.
If you say so.
What do you have, Hugh?
No date yet, but I do have a cause of death. Knife, between the right third and fourth ribs, next to the sternum. Serrated knife. So the killer was left-handed. Most like. She had a couple of broken ribs, long-healed. Her right wrist had a partially healed spiral break. There was also a hairline fracture on her right orbital bone. Probably happened at the same time as the arm. Someone beat her up before she died. Based on the healing a couple of weeks before. A more detailed report will take a while. We're still excavating the legs. This is good for now. Keep me posted. Jack put his car in drive and started.
Well, let's try this again.
He found it by chance when he saw Pollard painted in faint black letters on a large rusted mailbox with a loose red flag. Jack backed up and pulled onto the smooth oil dirt road. Two fat sorrel horses with thick blazes stood at the barbed wire fence, somnolent in the September heat. Their tails swished languidly at the flies on their backs. As Jack drove past, grasshoppers flew up from the wild blackberry bushes covering the barbed wire fences on either side of the road. The road dead-ended into the front yard of a plain, well-kept pier and beam house with a wide front porch. Behind the house, an old Ford tractor was parked in a wooden barn, weathered gray from years of exposure. If it weren't for the late model Dooley pickup in the front yard, door open and steadily dinging in protest, Jack would have thought he had stepped back in time. Jack unsnapped his holster and got out of his car. There was no movement anywhere. Dense woods closed in on the house from three sides.
Hello?
No answer. A long, large cooler and an overstuffed duffel bag were in the bed of the truck. Jack moved to the driver's side door, looked in the cab. It was clean and empty. He pulled the key out of the ignition to silence the incessant dinging. The quiet that greeted him was unsettling, unnatural. With relief, he heard one of the horses in the pasture behind him snort.
"What can I do for you, son?"
A large man wearing a low-profile gray felt Stetson walked out of the front door, loosely holding a shotgun in his right hand. Jack recognized him instantly.
"Buck Pollard?" he said with as much friendliness as possible.
"Yes."
"I'm Jack McBride."
"I know who you are."
Pollard locked his front door. He stopped at the top of the porch steps and surveyed Jack.
"Well, I thought I'd come introduce myself since we haven't had the opportunity to meet yet. Though,
Jack paused, as if searching his memory. "Weren't you at the Chevron the other day?"
"No, that couldn't have been you. You would have said something, right? Introduced yourself?"
"Thought you had enough on your plate."
"Oh, thoughtful of you."
The grasshoppers and cicadas were in a contest to see who could fill the silence with the most noise. Jack made a production of putting his hands in his pockets to show Pollard he wasn't threatened by him.
"Heard you got the tarnation beat out of you,"
Pollard finally said.
"I did."
"Shouldn't have taken them by yourself."
"Well, we're a little short-staffed at the moment."
"So I hear."
Jack jerked his head to the truck.
"Going somewhere?"
"Fishing."
"Where?"
"The Gulf."
"What do you fish for?"
"Whatever's biting." "You fish?"
"All the time."
"What for?"
"Information."
Jack waited a beat before continuing. He hoped he was hiding his chagrin at his stupid smart-ass answer as well as he meant to.
"Thought you might be able to fill me in on the town, the officers, people."
"Miner can do that."
"Sure, but who's going to fill me in on Miner?"
"I thought you were some fancy profiler."
"Well, that's a pretty blanket term. I'm not technically a profiler. Those agents analyze crime scenes and work up a profile of who might do it. You know, serial killers are white men, 25 to 40. Bunch of generalities anyone who watches Law and Order knows."
"Bunch of bullshit."
"I wouldn't call it that exactly."
"You don't need me to explain Miner to you."
"No, I think I understand him pretty well."
Pollard stayed on his porch, gun in his hand. He turned his head and spit a long brown stream of tobacco juice over the porch rail.
What do you need the shotgun for?
Protection.
From the fish?
Buck remained silent. Jack continued.
Did you know Gilberto and Rosa Ramos?
Nope.
I thought not. You weren't much for arresting anyone. Why mess with law-abiding illegals?
What do you mean by that?
Jack shrugged. Stillwater's crime rate is freakishly low. Almost as if crimes were waved away, ignored.
Why would I do that?
Oh, I know how the good old boy network works.
Do you?
Disdain dripped from both words, as if there were no way a city boy like Jack understood small towns and the people in them.
Maybe some father asks you to turn a blind eye to their kid's crimes in exchange for future favors. Maybe you catch someone dealing drugs and they offer to cut you in on the action for protection. Blind eyes being turned on wife beating, sexual assault, and child molestation. Favors could be material, could be something else. A cop who's been on the job for years could have a lot of dirt on a lot of people. Powerful stuff.
Do I look like I'm on the take?
Pollard gestured to his house and barn.
Actually, no. Everything was well kept, but average. Nothing flashy, save the truck. And Jack had seen enough dualies to know that being truck poor was almost a prerequisite for the men in Stillwater.
No, you hide it well.
Good luck proving anything.
It just takes one person coming forward, or one secret being unearthed.
Pollard stared hard at Jack before his face broke into a large grin.
You don't know shit. You just have people whispering in your ear about me, planting bugs.
Who would do that?
Ann Newberry and Jane Maxwell.
Why would they do that?
Hell if I know. Women like that hate men on principle because they think we have it easier than they do. Think on it. Has anyone else in this town had a bad word to say about me?
Jack thought back to the residents he had met. They mostly avoided talk of Pollard, but when they did, they always shared carefully worded generalities about his dedication to his job, all of his good works, and everything he had done for Stillwater.
I didn't think so, Pollard said.
Newberry and I didn't get along, but she ain't got it in for me like Jane Maxwell does. That woman can hold a grudge.
Well, what's her grudge with you?
That's no business of yours.
Well, you brought it up. I thought you might want me to investigate something.
I think you've got enough on your plate. Who knows? There might be a crime wave coming soon. If I were you, I'd start rounding up the Mexicans.
Why?
Those two murdered wetbacks? Probably drug-related.
Why do you say that?
Mexicans and drugs go hand in hand.
We didn't find any drugs.
Probably the person who found them took them. Sold them already, I'm sure.
How did you know it was a double murder? I just got confirmation of that a couple of hours ago.
Pollard laughed.
People still tell me things.
I'm sure they do. Then I suppose you heard about the skeleton we found on the Dodsworth's land.
I heard something about it. Any idea how long it had been there?
Not yet. It'll take a while to get a specific date. I'm just happy it wasn't a killing field.
Buck scoffed.
Got any leads?
Early days yet. Did you know the Dodsworths?
I know everyone in Stillwater.
Well, then I came to the right place.
I don't know what I can tell you that will help. George Dodsworth died in 84. Elizabeth is in Pembroke Arms. Can't remember her name from what I hear.
And Barbara?
Owns a cleaning business. Did time in Gatesville for check fraud. Clean since.
Were you friends with the Dodsworths?
Friends?
Pollard pushed his Stetson up and scratched his head.
No.
If you were running this case, what would be your theory?
Theory?
He settled his hat back in place.
Yeah. I have one. Miner has one. I'm curious what yours is.
Probably just someone passing through town who got caught in a bad situation.
Accidental death?
Uh-huh.
This stream of tobacco didn't have near the arc or distance. It landed with a splat on the porch rail. Pollard wiped spittle from his lips.
And the killer planted her in some random remote woods, most like.
So you think the killer was a local?
I didn't say that.
Didn't you?
Just as like, more like, someone transported the body from far off. Maybe another state.
Yeah, we're checking missing persons for the four-state area.
Four?
Mississippi, too. Was there any way to access that land back in the late 50s, besides driving right by the Dodsworth's house?
I don't remember. There might have been logging roads coming from the land behind.
Logging? I thought they didn't log the area until the 80s.
Been logging off and on since Stillwater was founded.
Jack looked around.
Haven't logged here, I see.
Interesting, Elizabeth Dodsworth didn't want them to log her land back in the 80s. Almost like she was hiding something. Wasn't much to find, anyway.
No weapon?
Jack shook his head.
Would have been nice, huh?
She didn't have any ID on her, either. Damn the luck.
What's your theory? Pollard said.
Mine? Well, being an outsider, I don't have a preconceived idea of people around here. The logical explanation is George Dodsworth killed her and buried her in the woods. Maybe she was a hitchhiker. He picked her up, fucked her, then murdered her. Buried her before his wife got home.
George wasn't the type.
Maybe Elizabeth caught them. Killed the woman. George buried her to protect his wife.
I can see George protecting her, but I can't see Elizabeth having the strength to stab someone.
Jack pursed his lips and nodded.
Amazing the things people do when provoked, in the heat of passion.
True.
Maybe George found Elizabeth and this vagrant in flagrante. Didn't realize his wife preferred women. Went into a rage. Have you noticed all of your scenarios involve sex?
Pollard sneered.
Sex is a powerful motivator, like jealousy, anger, betrayal. All powerful motives. Well, you would know.
Excuse me?
Jealousy, anger, betrayal as motives for murder.
Pollard spit another stream of tobacco juice on the ground.
They ever find your wife, by the way?
His face was blank, but his eyes were hard, calculating.
Or did they just drop the case because your mama told them to?
There was a roaring in Jack's ears. When he spoke, it sounded like a stranger talking. There was no investigation.
Not what I heard.
If you know all about it, why are you asking me?
Thought I'd see how honest you were.
I've got nothing to hide.
Pollard laughed. Everyone's hiding something. Well,
the word came out like he was stretching after a long nap.
As much as I would like to sit here and help you solve your cases, I have to get on the road.
Jack grabbed Pollard's arm as he walked by. Pollard stopped, stared at Jack's hand, then moved his eyes to Jack's face. A dollop of tobacco juice hung on the bottom edge of Pollard's mustache. Pollard's arm was surprisingly hard, like the arm of a man 30 years younger.
I don't know what you think you know, old man,
Jack said between gritted teeth.
I'll tell you what I think. I think only an idiot would grab a man who's carrying a loaded shotgun.
I'm not afraid of you.
You should be.
Pollard jerked his arm from Jack's grasp, walked to his truck, put the shotgun in the rack. It took all of Jack's willpower not to throw Pollard on the ground and beat the shit out of him. Pollard was in the driver's seat and was shutting the door when Jack spoke.
Thanks for talking to me. Very informative. Learned a lot.
Jack could see Pollard's eyes calculating, wondering what Jack meant, if he was bluffing. He turned on his truck and shut the door. Jack stood in the driveway and watched Pollard drive off. Very informative indeed. 5.
Does your dad ever feed you?
Ethan, Olivia, Mitra, and Troy were sitting together near the cafeteria door. Spread before Mitra and Olivia were homemade lunches, sandwiches, vegetables, hummus, fruit, and chips. Two lunch trays of half-eaten food were in front of Troy and Ethan. Olivia watched Ethan eat with a disgusted look on her face. Ethan wiped the dribble of gravy from his chin and swallowed.
Yes, but not homemade chicken fried steak.
I don't know how you all can eat that.
Because it's good,
Troy said around a mouthful of mashed potatoes.
Why don't you ever buy your lunch, Olivia? Ethan asked. I know what they do to make the food taste so good.
What?
Ethan asked.
Bacon grease, she stated.
She pulled the turkey off her sandwich.
What's wrong with bacon grease?
Ethan asked.
Besides being fattening?
Mitra asked.
Olivia is a borderline vegetarian. She doesn't have the guts to go full bore, though. Our dad would kill her,
Troy said.
He would not.
He wouldn't be happy.
Why would he care? Ethan asked.
His dad was a cattle farmer. He doesn't trust anyone that doesn't eat meat.
So it's not the grease you have a problem with, Ethan said to Olivia. It's the bacon.
Oh, no. I love bacon.
Ethan looked between his three friends, completely puzzled. Troy shrugged his shoulders as if to say, She's a girl. What do you expect?
Well, I don't care what they do to it. I didn't know cafeteria food could taste this good, Ethan said. Every school I've been to, the food has tasted like poo.
Ethan didn't want to say it, but compared to this food, his mother's cooking was bad. Since the only meal his dad could make was breakfast, there was no comparison necessary.
So, Mitra and I are going to study today after school. You two should probably join us,
Olivia said.
What for?
Troy asked.
For our first big test on Friday?
Ethan paused. Why would we start studying Monday for a test on Friday?
Yeah, that's overkill even for you, Olivia,
Troy said.
We thought studying a little each day would be better than cramming on Thursday night,
Mitra said.
I would, but I can't. I'm grounded, remember?
Ethan cut his eyes at Troy, who looked down at his plate.
Are you two still mad at each other?
Olivia asked.
About what?
Mitra asked.
Nothing,
Troy and Ethan said in unison. Mitra looked embarrassed and hurt, aware she was being left out of a secret. Ethan knew how that felt from first-hand experience. Hadn't his dad been keeping secrets from him for a year? He would rather get in trouble with his dad for telling Mitra than see her look so sad. How much more trouble could he get in, anyway? Ethan leaned across the table.
I texted Troy a picture I shouldn't have. His mom found it and told my dad.
Mitra turned as red as the square of jello on Ethan's tray.
Oh, not that kind of picture, Mitra,
Olivia quickly said. It took a moment or two for Ethan to realize what Olivia meant. When he did, his face turned as red as Mitra's.
God, no!
He leaned forward a little more. Mitra, Troy, and Olivia all leaned toward him.
It was of the skeleton,
Ethan whispered. Mitra's eyes widened.
You didn't?
Yeah, my dad was not happy.
It was a really cool picture,
Troy said. Olivia agreed.
Can I see it?
Mitra asked.
Dad deleted it from my phone. I deleted it too.
Mitra was dejected. Ethan said,
If I had it, I would let you see it.
She nodded and smiled.
It would probably give me nightmares anyway. Did you go around town Saturday?
Mitra asked.
Yeah.
Something kept Ethan from telling his friends about his run-in with Freeman.
Did y'all realize there are no sidewalks in Stillwater?
I've never thought about it,
Olivia said, her brows furrowed in concentration.
I've noticed,
Mitra said. Ethan wondered if she'd had the same problem as he had, but with residents calling the police about a strange Middle Eastern girl walking the streets.
I guess people just don't walk many places, Troy said.
Olivia's face cleared, and she took on a look of determination.
So, about studying,
Olivia said. Ethan learned early on that Olivia didn't give up easily.
I'm sure your dad would make an exception for studying.
Oh, I don't know. He didn't particularly want his dad to make an exception for studying.
I'll go see my mom at work and just happen to run into your dad. Parents love study groups. You'll be free in no time.
I'd hardly call study group freedom, Ethan murmured. Olivia can be convincing, Troy said. Olivia motioned to her brother with a smile.
See? Troy agrees.
You're going to search out my dad and ask him if I can do a study group? I don't think so.
Why not?
His dream of Olivia came rushing back to him in great detail. Ethan felt his face burning.
Because he'll never let me hear the end of it. We're just friends.
I know that, but he doesn't. Just don't ambush him, okay? I'll ask.
Are you all going to the book bank tonight?
Mitra asked. Olivia's eyes lit up.
Yes, perfect. I'll ask him then. Completely natural, because y'all will be with me when I do.
The book bank? Ethan asked.
Ellie's launch party,
Troy said.
Oh,
Ethan replied. The woman from the square, the one his dad seemed so interested in. Ethan started to think he should delete those pictures.
Ellie's one of my mom's best friends,
Troy said.
We've known her all our lives. We used to call her Aunt Ellie until she said it made her feel old,
Olivia said.
How old is she? My mom's age,
Olivia said.
She is totally awesome. She is very nice,
Mitra said.
Are you going tonight?
Olivia asked.
With my parents,
Mitra replied.
Dad hasn't said anything about it. We probably aren't invited.
Oh, you're invited, Olivia said.
My mom mentioned it. You'll be there.
Ethan's embarrassment about his dream had long since vanished, replaced by the irritation he felt whenever Olivia put on her know-it-all, hyper-confident attitude. Now he didn't want to go to whatever this party was just to prove her wrong.
I can't believe Stillwater is going to have a bookstore,
Mitra said. She swirled a carrot in her hummus and took a bite.
And a coffee shop, Olivia said.
I won't be hanging out there. I don't like books or coffee, Ethan said, standing.
Come on, pile it on. Ease up, grumpy cat,
Olivia said. Olivia and Mitra put their trash on Ethan's tray, and he picked up Troy's to take everything to the trash.
Isn't this sweet?
A muscular boy with the hint of a mustache on his upper lip stood at the end of the table, blocking Ethan's way.
Well, I don't know, Kevin. Dumping my lunch tray has never been the highlight of my day, but I'm new to Stillwater.
Maybe it is for the natives, Ethan replied. Kevin smirked.
The natives. Funny city boy.
And I wasn't even trying,
Ethan said, wondering what was so funny about his comment. He was trying to be insulting.
Ready for the game this week, Kevin?
Troy asked. Kevin Jackson stood a little straighter, as he always did when talking about football.
We're always ready to kick some ass.
He slammed his fist into his palm for emphasis. Ethan tried to stifle a laugh.
What's so funny, city boy?
Ethan shrugged.
Can a snipe kick anyone's ass? I mean, do they even exist? What exactly is a snipe? Ever seen one? Besides on your helmet?
Kevin stepped closer to Ethan and glared down at him.
Are you trying to piss me off?
Troy stood.
No, Kevin. He's just trying to learn as much about his new school as he can.
Ethan started.
Shut up, Ethan.
Olivia interjected. He shot her an annoyed look.
Yeah,
Kevin said.
Shut up, Ethan. What kind of pussy name is that?
Ethan put the trays down, but Troy moved in front of Ethan and shook his head. Kevin smirked before turning his attention to Olivia.
You're the one I wanted to talk to.
Really?
She asked. Her neck turned all splotchy.
Yeah. Want to walk to the DQ with me after school today?
She stammered, the blush completely overtaking her face.
She can't, Ethan interrupted. We've got study group.
The entire table went silent. Mitra suppressed a smile. Troy was completely baffled. Olivia's splotches evened out into a bright red. Ethan could almost see the waves of anger pulsing off her.
"That's tomorrow," Olivia said, fixing her blazing eyes on Ethan, daring him to contradict her.
Ethan tried to hide his mortification at saying anything, and he returned her angry stare. Olivia turned to Kevin and smiled.
"I'll meet you out front after school."
"Great," Kevin said. "See you later."
"See ya,"
she said. Ethan picked up the trays.
"Wow,"
Ethan said.
"I never thought you'd go out with a bully like Kevin Jackson."
He brushed past her. She turned on him and hissed.
"He's not a bully."
Ethan dumped the trash and put the trays in the window for the dishwasher. He faced Olivia, who had followed him.
Yeah, he is," Ethan said. "Or is calling people a pussy the way you bumpkins welcome people to Stillwater?"
He walked back to the table, Olivia on his heels.
"You've been here a few days and you think you know everything about everyone," she said. "I'm beginning to think Kevin's right about you."
"Well, I was obviously wrong about you. I wouldn't think you would defend a bully."
Olivia's eyes narrowed and she turned and stalked off. Ethan, Troy, and Mitra watched Olivia go.
"Well, Mitra, hope you didn't have your heart set on studying. You just got stood up," Ethan said.
Mitra shrugged.
"Tomorrow is fine."
"I can't believe Olivia would defend him like that," Ethan said to Troy, trying to ignore the stone of jealousy lodged in his stomach.
Troy shrugged.
"She's had a crush on Kevin for years. You kind of ruined the moment."
"Me? He's a bully and you know it. Isn't he, Mitra?"
She shrugged and picked up her bento box.
"See you in class,"
she said, and left.
"Thing is, Kevin's not a bully, Ethan," Troy said. "He really hates you for some reason, but overall he's a really good guy. Totally unlike his family. He just called me a pussy, and he cornered me in the locker room my first day. You were being rude to him. So that justifies it?"
Troy shrugged.
"No, but you being a smart ass might explain it. I can't explain the locker room. I didn't see it."
That was the problem. No one saw it. With no athletic clothes, of course his dad forgot, and no desire to play football, Coach Taylor had put Ethan in charge of filling water bottles for the real athletes. He had been alone in the locker room doing just that when he heard the clicking of cleats on the concrete floor and Kevin Jackson came around the corner, unzipping his football pants. He stopped when he saw Ethan. He walked to the urinal without a word. Ethan was fitting the tops on the water bottles when Kevin walked up behind him and stared at him in the mirror. For a moment, Ethan thought he was going to introduce himself. Then Kevin straightened his shoulders and his nervousness changed to bravado.
"I wouldn't bother making too many friends. Your dad will be out of a job by the end of the month. My uncle will see to it."
"Good. The quicker I get out of this shithole of a town, the better."
Kevin grabbed Ethan's shoulder and turned him around. He was at least 6 inches taller and 50 pounds heavier. Ethan saw a wispy mustache on Kevin's upper lip.
"Watch it, city boy."
"Great comeback, cracker."
Ethan heard the door to the locker room open. One of the coaches yelled in for Kevin. He had flipped the water bottles onto the ground and stalked out.
"You saying I made it up?" Ethan said to Troy now.
"No, but just because someone doesn't like you doesn't mean they're a bully."
Ethan wanted to argue, but kept his mouth shut. He didn't want to lose his only friend after barely a week in town. They wove through the crowd of students on the way to their lockers. Olivia glared at Ethan and shouldered past them without a word. Troy watched her stomp into her class.
"It is weird, though," Troy admitted.
"What?"
Ethan took his social studies book from his locker.
"Why he asked her out?"
"What's weird about that?"
"He's known for years that Olivia liked him. Why did he decide to ask her out now?"
"Maybe he realized how..."
Ethan stopped himself from saying something he would regret.
"Much he liked her,"
he finished instead.
"Or maybe he's trying to make you jealous."
"Me?"
Ethan said, his voice an octave too high.
Why would that make me jealous?
Troy rolled his eyes.
I'm not that stupid. See you in class.
Mitra walked up, holding her books close to her chest. She watched Troy walk away, disappointment written all over her face. She looked at Ethan and smiled.
Ready?
She asked.
You think Kevin's a bully too, don't you?
She sighed.
I'm not the best person to ask.
Why?
At one point or another, everyone has bullied me.
Ethan felt his stomach tighten. He asked the question, even though he didn't want to know the answer.
Even Troy and Olivia?
She shrugged.
We're going to be late for class.
She started walking. Ethan followed.
How long have you lived in Stillwater?
Ethan asked.
10 years.
Where are you from?
I was born in Houston. My parents left Iran when the Shah left. They were kids.
Why Stillwater?
My dad bought an oil well servicing company here. He wanted my brother and me to grow up in a small town.
Olivia glanced up when they entered the classroom and gave Ethan a withering glare. She was making a big production of slamming books and jerking the zipper of her backpack. Damn, she had a temper. Just like Ethan's dad. He knew Troy was right. Kevin had asked Olivia out to piss Ethan off and make him jealous. Whether Kevin was quick enough to see that Ethan liked Olivia or just assumed it because he spent so much time with her, Ethan wasn't sure. Either way, Ethan knew he needed to distance himself from her, not only because he didn't want everyone to figure out he was having wet dreams about her, but also because he didn't want Kevin freaking Jackson to date Olivia just to spite him. He got a funny, fluttery feeling in his stomach at that idea. It quickly changed to nausea when he thought of what the innocent-sounding walk to DQ actually meant. He'd heard through snatches of conversation that these walks were merely excuses to detour through an abandoned, overgrown lot and make out. The idea that this was Kevin's ultimate intention, and why wouldn't it be, made Ethan want to puke. And that Olivia, being a local and knowing much better than Ethan what a walk to DQ meant, would still choose to go with that Neanderthal, made him furious. 6. With a small pocket knife that once belonged to his dad, Jack cut the yellow crime scene tape, sealing the front door of the Ramos' trailer. He put on gloves and went inside. He closed the door and surveyed the room. The spicy aroma so prominent the day of the murders had dissipated, replaced with the musty smell of disuse. A thin veneer of dust covered the counters and tabletops. It settled into the fabric of the sofa and chair and lay lightly on the carpet, worn shiny and flat from years of use. Jack dropped his duffel bag on the floor and, starting on the left, methodically began his search. Behind and underneath the sofa, below the cushions. With a grimace, he shoved his hand between the frame of the sofa where the back met the seat and scooped out years' worth of loose change, used condoms, chip bags, paper clips, pen caps, dried-out pens, plastic spoons, a butter knife, a plastic ring, a yo-yo, an empty snuff can, a tampon, unused, thank God, and a pair of panties too large to be Rosa Ramos's. He repeated the search with the chair, finding much of the same. He ran his hands under the coffee table and lifted it. Nothing but green, blue, and red gum and dried boogers. He opened every drawer, cabinet, and appliance in the kitchen, came up with nothing interesting or out of place, and moved down the hall and into the bathroom. Despite being abandoned for a week, it smelled fresh and looked clean. A medicine cabinet full of over-the-counter drugs, condoms, tampons, a rubber bulb parents use to clear the mucus from babies' noses, a tiny set of fingernail clippers next to a larger pair for adults, a black comb with broken teeth, a can of Axe, and a small bottle of Jennifer Lopez perfume. A round hairbrush, matted with black hair, lay on the clean sink next to a small jelly jar holding two toothbrushes and a twisted tube of toothpaste. The toilet was clean, inside and out, but no amount of scrubbing could get rid of the years of neglect the toilet suffered before being saved by Rosa Ramos's good housekeeping. Jack lifted the lid off the back of the toilet. nothing except a small dispenser of bleach that would release when flushed. The shower, hard water stains notwithstanding, was spotless as well. Jack stood in the doorway to the bedroom for a long time. It was a pocket door, necessary because having a door that would swing open would drastically reduce the floor space in the room. When he tried to close the door, it jumped off the runner and jammed into the wall. It took Jack 5 minutes to get the door back on track. Obviously, it wasn't closed when the killer arrived. Jack doubted Gilberto and Rosa used it at all. The bed was next to the door of the small room. They would have seen their killer immediately, even if they had been making love, which they clearly had been. Jack turned and stood in the hallway next to the door, his back to the wall. He took his gun out and held it next to his ear. He pivoted into the doorway and pretended to shoot Gilberto, then Rosa. A few seconds was all it would have taken for a man who knew how to handle a gun. They never knew what hit them. He put his gun back in his holster. Jack searched through the inside of every drawer, pulled them out, felt underneath, and looked inside the dresser frame. He moved it away from the wall and looked behind. He got down on his hands and knees, shined his maglight under the dresser, then turned it under the bed. He pulled the long, thin plastic bins from beneath the bed and searched them. Nothing. Same with the closet. Nothing. He tapped his flashlight on his leg and took one last look around. For someone who liked to hide things, according to her brother, there was nothing interesting to be found. Were Rosa and Gilberto really this boring? Or had someone cleaned up before the police arrived? The killer? Or Diego Vasquez? Jack moved to the nursery. Where all the other furniture in the house was obviously secondhand, the nursery furniture was new. Brand new. Underneath the crib was a plastic bag full of instructions and warranties, and a Walmart receipt dated August 29. 3 weeks ago, Rosa and Gilberto bought $750 worth of baby furniture, toys, and clothes in cash. Jack pulled a small baggie from his pocket, placed the receipt inside. Besides a few unpaid bills in a kitchen drawer, Jack hadn't found evidence of a bank account or personal paperwork. He didn't expect to. Rosa and Gilberto worked in cash jobs, though what either of them could have done to earn so much cash, he could only guess. The baby's room was mostly empty since clothes, diapers, toys, and supplies had been given to the foster family. It turned out Miner had been right about the woman he gave the baby to. She was well known to the county Child Protective Services and had taken in Mexican babies for them before. Jack dumped the contents of the duffel bag on the kitchen table, tossed the empty bag aside, and sat down. He took all the items from the evidence bags, placed them in the middle of the table, and stared at the meager possessions the crime scene tech had found in the bedroom the morning of the murders. The pay-as-you-go phones sat atop the printouts of their activity over the last month. Gilberto called and texted very few people, and had never set up his voicemail. Rosa made more calls, recently mostly to doctors and numbers in Mexico that Jack assumed were family members and were being traced. Her voicemail had been empty. Jack picked up Gilberto's wallet. The edges of the black leather were worn from use, and the shape of the wallet indicated it was normally much fuller than Jack found it. The contents were uninteresting. Driver's license, a Walmart portrait of Rosa and the baby, $23, and a Chevron receipt for chips, Mountain Dew, and a candy bar. Gilberto might have been the dullest murder victim Jack had ever come across. His investigation hadn't found one motive for anyone, even Rosa, to kill Gilberto. He was a good guy, hard worker, loving husband and father. He drank a lot on the weekends, but what hard-working man didn't? His drinking never led to trouble with the police. There was no record of Stillwater police ever having contact with Gilberto, or Rosa for that matter. Try as he might, Jack could not profile Gilberto. He left very little impression on the home he lived in and supported. The people who knew him spoke of him in banal generalities, as if struggling to pinpoint why they liked him, and realizing maybe they didn't after all. Jack had little doubt that Rosa had ruled the roost. The trailer spoke of a proud woman making the best of what she had. Everything was clean, the trash in the frame of the furniture notwithstanding. Even the best housekeepers missed that. And obsessively organized. She was practical, using space under the bed for storage in a tiny room. Conscientious, baby-proofing the house months before necessary. And frugal. Food was off-brand, bought on sale and in bulk. Her one weakness, though, was family, as evidenced by using their recent cash windfall for the baby and her willingness to let her brother sleep on their couch and start a new life in Stillwater. Or did she have no choice but to let Diego stay with her? Jack still remembered little from Diego's attack, but the feeling that Diego was dangerous and he was lucky to be alive was constant. Unlike questions about Gilberto and Rosa, which were answered easily, everyone was reticent about Diego. When they said they didn't know him, they were relieved. Jack dumped Rosa's purse on the table. Her wallet was a coin purse containing her driver's license, green card, obviously fake, $3.23 in change, and $289 in cash. Gum, Altoids, dental floss, two tampons, a panty liner, mascara, a half-used tube of Carmex, grocery receipts, paid in cash, the electric bill and gas bill clipped together, ponytail holders, a hairbrush, a small, partially burned vanilla-scented jar candle, a travel-sized package of tissues, hand lotion, and stick deodorant. Jack sighed. Nothing. He stared at the shit spread before him. It looked more like a medicine cabinet than a purse. He picked up the scratched and scarred wintergreen Altoids tin. He opened it and wrinkled his nose as the faint scent of wintergreen wafted up to him. Inside was a necklace with a St. Peter medal, a small key that would fit a luggage lock, and a business card with Martes, 830, 24 River Road, written on the back. Jack turned the card over. Spick and Span Cleaning, Barbara Dodsworth, owner, he read. Jack flipped the card back over and stared at the address. Jack tapped the card on the table. Huh. He put the card down, picked up the candle, removed the lid, and sniffed it. What were the chances of his murder victim being connected to his 50-year-old murder? He put the candle down, opened the Carmex, and smelled it. There was no such thing as coincidence, right? He wrinkled his nose at the lotion. He hated the smell of lavender. Of course, there had to be a lot of coincidence in a town the size of Stillwater. Everyone was connected to everyone else in some way. Except him. He was well and truly an outsider. He picked up the deodorant and pulled off the cap. He stared down into the base of it. Instead of a white slab of chalky deodorant, a piece of paper, folded tightly into a square, was wedged into the empty base. Jack removed the paper and carefully unfolded it. An old family portrait was copied crookedly on the 8x11 paper. Four unsmiling children stood around the stoic mother and father, who sat, not touching, on a settee. A plump baby in a christening gown sat on the mother's lap, her head turned toward the girl standing to her mother's left, smiling. The large raised birthmark on the baby's cheek would have drawn the eye of the beholder, if not for the swastika armband and lightning bolt insignia on the dour officer's uniform. 7. Ellie had lied to Jack when she said owning a bookstore was a childhood dream. Her childhood dream had been to live inside books, to escape into worlds full of color, life, adventure, and especially love. She woke each morning and for a few moments kept her eyes closed, hoping against hope she would open them and see the attic of the March sisters, the dormers of Green Gables, or the rough-hewn boards of Little House on the Prairie. Instead, she was always greeted with a water stain shaped like the state of Maryland on her ceiling, a drunken father when he was there at all, and an empty refrigerator. Living inside books was a nice idea, but it didn't accomplish anything or change reality, and the reality was Ellie had a father who resented her for myriad reasons, all of which were out of Ellie's control. She wasn't a boy, and all of the property and wealth Jacob York married her mother for was bequeathed to Ellie in an airtight trust, which meant Jacob York IV, the direct descendant of Jacob York I, the founder of Stillwater, was dependent on his young daughter for money. Unless he wanted to get a job, which he didn't. Of course, Ellie would have given it all to her father for one kind word, or even a sincere lie. However, she didn't gain control of the money until she was 25. Until then, it was under the strict control of Jane Maxwell, who hated Jacob York more than he hated his daughter. Which is why Gabrielle Robichaud York had made Jane the executor of her will, instead of her husband. She knew Jane would protect Ellie's interests. 1 year ago today, Big Jake York had died, nursing his resentment against Ellie and Jane and plotting new ways to wrest control of his money from his daughter to his dying breath. Ellie paused, mascara wand in her hand. It was only natural, she supposed, to be thinking of her dead father on the night she was finally putting his ghost to rest. Jacob York hated books, hated anything that might make Ellie happy. Opening a bookstore on the anniversary of his death was the biggest fuck you she could think of. She knew its impact would have been greater if he could have seen all of the money, his money, she was sinking into a bookstore in a dying town full of magazine-reading rednecks during the worst economic downturn since the Depression. But when it came to her father, her resentment and anger didn't supersede her fear of town scrutiny. There had even been a minuscule part of her that hadn't wanted him to die completely broken. As such, she played the part of dutiful daughter to the bitter end. Only two people knew the true provenance of the book bank. Jane Maxwell, the woman who taught her to be an implacable businesswoman, and Shirley Underwood, the woman who taught her compassion. The alarm on her phone went off. Her 20 minutes were up. She applied a small amount of lip gloss, rubbed her lips together, and pursed them at her reflection. "That's as good as it's going to get," she said. She flipped the light off and went downstairs. Shirley bustled around, putting the final touches on the buffet table. Her husband, Bob, organized canned drinks, water bottles, and small cups around the square bin of ice. Paige Grant stood on a step stool behind the coffee bar, writing the coffee menu on a chalkboard with much better lettering than Ellie had managed earlier in the day. A couple of Mexican women, hired for the night, walked around the store, dusting the already clean displays, killing time before their real duties began.
"Looks great, Shirley," Ellie said.
"Thanks, darling," she replied.
She moved the plates a fraction and straightened. Then she opened her arms and walked toward Ellie.
"I'm so proud of you."
Ellie fell easily into the arms of the woman who had been her surrogate parent for nearly 30 years. Bob walked up and patted Ellie on the back, a significant show of affection for him.
"We both are," he said.
Ellie pushed away from Shirley, but was not released from Shirley's firm grip.
"I haven't done anything yet."
Shirley ran her hand fondly down Ellie's hair.
"We all know that's a lie, but we also know you are self-deprecating to a fault."
"That's what Shirley's here for, to brag about you,"
Bob said. Shirley looked over Ellie's shoulder toward the door.
"Speaking of..."
Ellie turned and saw Jack McBride walk in the door with Ethan. Ellie's stomach lurched. She'd been planning how to avoid him since Susan confirmed he was coming. How was she going to be able to avoid him if he showed up early? Of course, he walked right up to her, smiling that ridiculous toothpaste commercial smile.
"Glad you could make it."
"Well, thanks for inviting us."
"Thanks for coming. Hi, Ethan."
"Hi."
His eyes barely met hers before dropping.
"Troy and Olivia are going to be here soon. Until then, help yourself to the food and drinks."
She waved to the table at the back of the store.
There are some books on photography in the nonfiction section if you're interested.
Thanks, he mumbled.
Ethan!
Paige Grant called to him from behind the counter.
Come over here and let me experiment on you.
Ethan blushed and looked to his dad.
Decaf,
Jack warned. Ellie watched Ethan walk away. When she turned her attention back to Jack, he had an expectant look on his face. He opened his mouth to speak, but Ellie got there first. Ellie stood back.
You remember Shirley Underwood?
She said. Jack arranged his face in a pleasant expression.
Of course, he said. Good to see you again.
Before Shirley could respond, Ellie continued,
This is her husband, Bob. His law office is right across from City Hall.
Bob was a large man with a booming voice and jocular personality. He pumped Jack's hand.
Nice to meet you. I've heard a lot about you.
Jack smiled and nodded.
You haven't called me yet,
Shirley said. Was I supposed to?
As soon as you needed something,
she said.
I guess he hasn't needed anything, Shirley,
Bob said.
Don't be foolish. Of course he has. Look at that face. He's just too embarrassed to ask.
There is one thing I need.
Name it.
I need to steal Ellie for just a minute.
Without waiting for permission, he took Ellie by the elbow and steered her to the back of the store.
Take her for as long as you like,
Shirley cooed. Ellie didn't like the knowing tone of voice Shirley used, nor did she like being given and taken like she was someone's possession. She pulled her elbow from Jack's grasp. So far, the night was a disaster. Her one objective was to stay away from Jack McBride, and here it was, 6:58 p.m., and he had gotten her alone. She stopped next to the buffet table, determined to not go into the back and be completely alone with him.
So, about earlier, Ellie closed her eyes and shook her head.
Look, let's just forget about the whole thing. Pretend it never happened,
but
I jumped to the wrong conclusion, and now I'm mortified. Just,
she sighed, met his eyes.
I really wish you hadn't come.
Jack pressed his lips together. He jingled the keys in his pockets.
What wrong conclusion?
That you were...
She stopped. Interested in me? Flirting with me? Of course she had the wrong idea, but she didn't want to degrade herself by admitting it. Why would he ask her to? Was he that cruel?
God, are you really going to make me say it?
I'm pretty sure you...